You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Happy humid Thursday, Canada. If you're out west, it's very hot. We're thinking about all our beautiful western listeners battling those fires, worried about their homes. The humidity in the east, all across this country, we're experiencing different things. I have to tell you that today is I will be taking a summer break after today, a little summer holiday. And the reason I'm doing it is because I've got to jam it in now before the election, which is going to come sometime in August. I'm thinking either first or second week of August, as I've told you all. So get ready for that. Justin Trudeau's taking holidays the first week of August, and then basically from the second week on, it's game on. And all the parties are preparing. And so I got, you know, I wasn't planning to take, I was planning to work a little more in July, but all my planned August holidays are changed. I'm not saying this to whine. I'm just giving you a sense of what's coming. And a lot of things are changing. An election has an impact on everybody. And later in the program, I'm going to ask you, because I need to get your sense of things. One thing I love about our program is that I get to hear from you, and I get to hear what is going to affect. There's going to be an election. We know that. Trudeau's marching across the country as our ministers dropping promises of billions of dollars, tourism dollars, transport dollars, green dollars, childcare. We know what his plan is because that's what the budget is. Aaron O'Toole was at the Calgary Stampede. He's making promises. Jagmeet Singh's making promises. By the way, both, all three of them, Trudeau, O'Toole, and Singh, have all promised a million jobs. This is the Oprah election. You get a million jobs, and you get a million jobs, and you get a million jobs. Now, here's the thing about a million jobs. It's a great political number. It sounds big, because it is. The problem is, the jobs are coming back anyway. We saw the monetary report from the Bank of Canada. Jobs are coming back. There's going to be international growth is going to be massive, and job growth is coming. So, you know, they will be able to meet their promise of a million jobs, any of them, probably without very much policy. It's coming anyway. It's like promising water when you know it's going to rain. I will promise you as much water as you need, but the forecast calls for rain. So it's not much, you know, it's not you that's making the water. You're just, you know, the rain is coming. The problem is those are not all permanent jobs. They're not all high paying jobs. They're not all the jobs you need. They may not even be the jobs in the right sector. Canada's got an innovation problem. Canada's got a deficit problem. Canada's got all sorts of disparities regionally. We've got all sorts of issues. So, you know, just saying a million jobs isn't that helpful. What kind of jobs? Where will the jobs come from? Are they sustainable jobs? Are they jobs in innovation? Are they jobs that are going to last? Are they jobs for transition? Are they jobs that are requiring public support or not? So be wary of bumper sticker promises. Nonetheless, it's all coming. But when I'm looking at an election, look, we're all going to do what ridings, what regions, what promises. We'll break it down for you. And I'm going to ask you what's going to affect your vote, because I need to listen to you as we get through the phony war. This is the phony election war, the barbecue circuit where the leaders are testing out ideas, testing out messages, testing out promises. You know, they're figuring it out right now. This is the dry run. This is the phony war. Oh, that's resonating. Oh, that hooked in. So you're going to see all these leaders testing things out in July, getting ready for August as they're prepping their election machines. But what will affect your vote? Just, I really want you to text me now, and then we'll do a call-in later in the program. And we got a great show for you. Is it the pandemic and how it was handled? Is it the recovery, a referendum on the recovery? Is it a specific problem and promise like childcare, health, universal dental care, universal drug coverage? Is it job creation? Is it ethics? ethics and scandals. Time for a change. Is it the deficit? Will it be issues like the unmarked graves that keep getting found? Indigenous-related issues, residential school issues. Today, by the way, right now, as we're speaking, remember the 215 unmarked graves found in Kamloops at the residential school there. We will get the report out today, and we will talk about it in about an hour. Are they going to actually find out exact numbers of who was buried there? Will we identify and get to know any of the names of the kids that were stolen and then put in unmarked graves? That's now. That's today. That's what's going on right now. We're going to cover that today. Will that affect you? What about climate? Coming up next on the program, do you know what? Maybe you were too busy basking in your own summer here, but you may have missed what happened at the EU. Something like insane is happening here. The European Union, 27 countries, has put forward some of the most stringent rules to get to net zero by 2050. Like no more cars on gas or diesel within 9 years. And they're going to impose a border tax on imports on products that do not have a good climate change plan for carbon emissions. The U.S. is looking at this too. A border adjustment tax, it's called. Basically, it's if you're producing stuff like China, if you're producing steel and you don't have a carbon emissions plan, you're going to get taxed at the border of the EU. It's a big deal. We're going to break that down for you. This is a huge, huge deal if it works. And by the way, people say, a lot of you will write to me at 71010 and say, Evan, you know what you never talk about? And I'll say, what? You always talk about climate and carbon emissions and Canada's, what's Canada doing? And you never talk about the big emitter, China. China's not part of the Paris Accord. And if you look at the top 25 emitting urban centers, about 22 or 23 of them are in China. And you never talk about that. They're putting more coal online, China, China, China. Without China, the rest of it's useless. Let me just respond to that very quickly because it's a very good point. Number one, later this month, China is probably going to unveil a carbon market, a price on carbon and a big carbon market like they have in the EU and like Quebec has. So they're about to do something. Two, China's the largest producer of solar energy. Now, by the way, we got to make sure they're not producing that with Uyghur labor because of the what many recall the genocide going on in that province. And I know the Chinese flip when you say that, but it's hard to ignore. But yeah, China's a big emitter, and that's a huge problem. But let me just ask you this. When you go to Tim Hortons and you go to the drive-thru, do you chuck all your garbage on the road as soon as you finish it? Ah, there goes my donut. There goes my coffee cup. There goes all my wrapping. There goes my bag and my straw and everything. And someone says to you, why are you littering? And you say, hey, man, I only contribute to 0.001 of the garbage in the city. The city's not doing enough anyway. I don't care. It's not a big deal. That's not collective act. You don't do that because collective action means even the smallest gesture matters. You don't throw your garbage in the street because you barely statistically make a difference. Yes, Canada's not a huge polluter, but everyone's got to do it together. That's the whole point of dealing with this. And China is going to do it, and the international community's got to force them to do it. And the EU is about to do that. Now, we're going to dig into that next. I want to talk about that because if we don't understand that, we can't understand what we're voting for in this coming up election. As Wayne Gretzky says in the most overused Canadian expression, don't go where the puck is, go to where the puck is going to go. Look, coming up next, the climate puck in the EU, the biggest economic bloc, is about to go to a place where Canada hasn't even gone yet. Where is it, and what will that mean for this country? We dig into that next.
making sense of the latest news. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program. Look, price on carbon is going to be a big election issue. And if you think the conservatives who are going to finally unveil a price on carbon, as Aaron O'Toole did, that's controversial. The world may be changing. Is China about to have a carbon market? What about the EU? Have they just unveiled something that might be a game changer if it works? And including some kind of tax on goods that are high emitters, something the US has even spoken about. Now, the reason I think you should know about this is, as I always say, and this is the most Canadian overused tired expression, but the old Gretzky thing, don't go where the puck is, go to where the puck is going. And is this where the climate puck is going? Michael Bernstein is the executive director of Clean Prosperity. He joins us now. Michael, always a pleasure. When I need to know stuff about this, I love calling you. What has the EU done and why does it matter to Canadians?
Well, the EU just put out a proposal yesterday for how they are going to get to a very ambitious climate target. They want to reduce their emissions by more than half over the next 8.5 years by 2030. And in order to do that, they also put in place what they're calling a border carbon adjustment. So what that means is they're going to charge imports of things like steel and fertilizer and other things that come into the continent effectively a tax, so that they protect their domestic industry. And I think it's really opening up a new frontier in kind of the climate journey of all countries, including Canada, because we've got to figure out how are we going to reduce emissions, but also protect our industry and our economy at the same time.
Michael, a lot of people don't know what a border carbon adjustment is. And it's been talked about even in the U.S., and people are always wondering, you know, how are we going to get China to buy in if they don't buy into things? But a border carbon adjustment, in other words, a tax on goods that are high emitting, that changes the price. And that means it's an incentive for more domestic suppliers to actually get the sale. Tell me about how that would work, what it could mean.
Yeah, so if you are a steel producer in Hamilton, for example, you are being asked, based on climate targets, to reduce your emissions. But obviously, to reduce your emissions, to change to renewable electricity or make other changes to your plant, that's going to impose costs on you. And the last thing that anybody wants, that steel producer in Hamilton or Canadians at large want, is for that steel producer in Hamilton to say, you know what, things have gotten too expensive and I can't compete with China. So I'm going to move my steel plant over to China or maybe even just to the U.S. But either way, we would lose jobs in that case and emissions wouldn't even go down. So that would be a big, big problem. So this new this border carbon adjustment, and you described it well, is trying to deal with that question. And it's saying, look, steel producer, let's say DeFasco or somebody in Hamilton, we are going to try to help you by saying that steel from China, that is also going to face a charge. We're not just going to put a carbon tax on the steel at home. We're going to make sure that stuff coming into our country also has a carbon tax too. So we're competing on a level playing field. So that's the basic idea. Let's let industry in Canada, if we're going to reduce our emissions, we've got to stay even right, with foreign competition.
But Michael, the question is, will that just make things more expensive? I mean, the whole point of globalization and supply chains is that we're getting goods much cheaper. Will these kind of taxes, which is essentially a tariff, maybe protecting the industry, but from a consumer point of view, great, our steel just got more expensive.
Yeah, it's definitely a concern. And yeah, it could raise costs in certain situations. Now, of course, over time, we know things like renewable electricity are becoming cheaper than old forms of fossil fuel electricity, for example. So in the long term, maybe not. But yeah, sure, there will be some cost considerations that we're going to have to, that the Canadian government and others are going to have to deal with, because you're right, Canadian consumers don't want to pay more for their goods.
Right. No, and the point is, if all of Europe is doing it, it may, this is the question, if everyone's doing it, then the price crushes, right? Because you need more people, more countries to do it. The other thing that the European Union is doing is they want to basically ban fossil fuel powered cars within 14 years.
Yeah, I mean, look, the EU put out a very ambitious package. You're right. They want to, they are asking, they're saying no more sales of internal combustion engines by 2035. And they're talking about now putting taxes on aviation and shipping. They've got very ambitious targets around retrofitting buildings. They want to do 3% of public buildings a year. So it's a very ambitious package. But you know what? Canada is also looking to do something similar. The whole world has to do something similar if we're really going to meet our climate targets. So the EU is really significant because it often leads the way. It is often ahead of the pack saying, this is a pathway we can take to reduce our emissions. And when it comes to cars, for example, Canada just announced a very similar policy. Now, they haven't put legislation in place, but our government, I think it was last week or the week before, said we're going to have the exact same target. 100% of cars are going to be either electric or hydrogen-based by 2035.
Someone's going to say, well, boy, everyone, we're just shooting ourselves in the foot because China's not doing it. I've heard that as early as tomorrow, there's going to be a carbon market in China, that China's going to unveil that. What is China doing here? I know they're the biggest emitters. 23 of the 25 largest emitting areas, cities are China, are cities in China. What are they doing? And is this carbon market that I understand they're about to launch, is that a serious thing?
It is a serious thing. They've been piloting this for a couple of years now. It's mainly in their power sector. But yeah, China is the elephant in the room. They are a huge player, and we cannot get to our climate goals without them. So I think they've taken some really positive steps. This carbon pricing system is one of them. It applies only to electricity for now, but it is a very important step. They're also doing a lot in terms of investing in renewables and other forms of clean energy. So
I know, but they're building coal plants.
Here, right?
I mean, I know, but they're building, coal plants like crazy.
Absolutely. And that's exactly what I was just going to say. I mean, China is a real mixed bag. I mean, you could point to the coal plants they're building. You could point to the amount of cement they're pouring. I could give you 5 or 10 reasons why China is still a huge problem. And I could give you a bunch of reasons why they are potentially going to be part of the solution. For example, China is producing as many EVs, as much solar capacity, as much wind capacity as the rest of the world combined. So China, we've got some positives and we've got some real negatives coming out of China. And the key is, how do we build on the momentum we're seeing there? Let's congratulate them for the couple of positive steps they've made. They've got a long road to go here. But I think we have to take something like this carbon market as at least a positive step.
Yeah, always hard to congratulate China on this stuff, but I know what you mean. At least we're urging them forward. Just quickly, in the last minute I've got, we were probably going to have a federal election in August, early or late August. Does climate become a big ballot box in your mind? Is this a ballot box question, or does it take the sideline now to economic recovery or other issues?
I think it's going to be an important, I think it is going to be an important factor. It may not be the lead issue you hear the parties talking about, but you know, even in the last couple of weeks, you've seen the federal government come out with some very significant climate announcements, whether it was some of the high-speed rail or whether it was some of the funding for steel plants and other things. So I think you're going to see climate still be, you know, near the top of the list. I don't think it will rank as highly as the economy or COVID, but there's a lot of voters out there, and we see that in a lot of our polling, who say, look, if I don't feel a politician or a party has a credible climate plan, they're off the list for me. In other words, I need a credible plan to consider you, and maybe I'm going to make my decision on other issues. Climate is still going to play a role.
Yeah, there's a bit of a green backdrop to almost every platform now. So that never used to be the case. That's a dramatic shift. Michael Bernstein, great to have you on the program as always. You're just like, I really feel informed after we speak. I really appreciate it. I hope you and the family are well. And thanks so much.
Appreciate it, Evan. Thanks a lot.
Michael Bernstein, Executive Director of Clean Prosperity. And again, I'm trying to set you up with the info that you need. You know, when you text me at 7:10 and say, hey, what about China? I'm going to ask the people who know so we can know. So you say, okay, well, I get that. Okay, it's a mixed bag. All right, coming up, though, there was a study done that Canada allows too many drinks a week and that alcohol consumption is bad. It can link to cancer. How many drinks do you have a week? I'm going to tell you the data on this study. Many people are drinking because of the pandemic, and then we'll get your thoughts next. So get ready to have a few on the Evan Sullivan Show.
as your world changes, we adapt to get your answers. Now more with Evan Solomon.
Are you drinking more? Did you drink more in the pandemic? Stats say people did. Overdose deaths and alcohol-related deaths for people under 65 in this country during the COVID pandemic were up, according to StatsCan. They have some, how about this for depressing? The Canadian Vital Stats on Death Database. God, imagine working there. 5,535 more deaths than expected in those younger than 65 by the end of March 2020 to the beginning of April 2021. And about 1,380 were in large part related to substance abuse. And I want to know this because there's a new study out, and the Globe had a story about it, which says that, you know, there's a link now to alcohol and cancer, and that we're drinking too much, and the recommended dose for Canadians to drink is like 15 drinks a week. I guess it's 15 drinks a week. It's 21 in Spain. 21. I'm now, you know, like I'll have a beer or a glass of wine or a scotch, but I don't have it very often. Not a huge issue for me. But a lot of people have a beer every night or two beers every night or a drink every night or a bottle of wine. How many drinks do you have a week? And does the study about what's safe, which basically says you should cut it out, worry you? I'll give you some stats as you dial in at 1-855-633-1010, 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. The drinking thing is kind of a remarkable thing, because the Center for Addiction and Mental Health says that there's now a link between cancer and drinking, and even moderate drinking. They were working with the WHO, and they published this in Lancet Oncology, and they basically says 4% of new cases in 2020 have been associated with drinking alcohol, new cases of cancer. In Canada, researchers said, according to this Globe article, that alcohol was linked to 7,000 new cancer cases last year. 24% of breast cancer, 20% of colon cancer, 15% of other, rectal and oral and liver. Like, it's bad. And I'm just thinking, people just want to have a drink and relax. They're already so stressed. But Dr. Mitch Shulman, News Talk 1010's chief medical officer, discussed the results with Mark Toohey this morning, and here's what he said about it.
Our whole thinking about alcohol has undergone a dramatic transformation from a medical perspective within the last 5 to 10 years. And it's a bigger understanding of how its cumulative effect on us is bad.
Yeah, it's bad. How many drinks do you have a week? Does all this study worry you? Are you going to cut back, or do you think, no, you know what, there's other things to worry about? 1-855-633-1010, 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. Alcohol is so culturally acceptable, but we never talk about the social cost of alcohol. Evan, for years now, two beers on Saturday, two on Sunday. Used to have one beer every day and extra weekends. Decided in 2006, nope, too expensive, not good for health and sleep. Yeah. Evan, I'm 23. I don't drink, but I smoke a lot of weed. And I wonder if that's the case for people. I'm not recommending it. That may happen to a ton of people. 15 a week, that seems like a lot. Yeah, that's what they say. By the way, it's way higher. The states in Canada have about 15 a week. We're on the high end. I think only Spain, according to this article, is higher than us. I recommend 21. Some are like 10 or 8 or 7. It's quite remarkable. I gave up drinking 10 years ago and I switched to weed. There's a lot of that. Call me if you're doing that. I'm really intrigued by that. Has that happened? Are you replacing one with another? Because a lot of people are drinking a lot more. It's expensive. It's expensive. 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. I'll tell you what was my big sticker shock is when my wife and I went out to dinner. We've gone out like twice since the pandemic's over. You just forget. You have one drink. Like, we went out for our anniversary. One drink. Like, it's astonishing how much of your bill is alcohol. And now I know restaurants make a lot of money on the alcohol. But my God, if you go out and you are doing serious drinking out of your house, that is an absolute financial killer, let alone the health consequences. Now, these studies are always a bit of a downer, but I tell you, it really, really makes a difference to a lot of people. Someone just says this, and I think this is key, because I don't like to judge people. I mean, I don't drink or smoke. I don't do drugs, but I get why it's on the rise. Life is stupid stressful right now. I just hope when things settle down, people can drop the habit and cut back for their own health. This is the one thing that we're not talking about enough, is the stress levels that people are hearing. Stress is so critical right now, and people are turning to booze. Mike, you're on the line. What's up?
Hello.
What's your take on this, Mike?
Well, myself and my friends, I drink beer. I don't drink liquor, per se, but I consume probably around 70 drinks a week.
And you drink 10 beers a day?
Easily. Fridays and Saturdays, I can drink a 2-4, right? I've been doing that for decades.
Mike, but, like, do you drink during the day?
No, not at work, no.
So you come home and you'll pile back 10 beers. Wow.
Easily. If I drank 10 beers, you'd have no idea that I had 10 beers.
You're sober after 10 beers over at what period? Wow.
Well, I'm not going to say I'm sober. I wouldn't get in the car and drive, but... you wouldn't be able to tell that I had 10 beers, right?
Dude, that is expensive living.
It's expensive, but yeah. But my health, too, I'm not overly concerned because I eat very well, right? A lot of people drink and they don't eat, right? They don't eat for days, right? I eat very well, and I'm always...
Why do you need 10? I'm intrigued. I'm not trying to judge you, believe me. Why do you need 10 beers a night?
No, I don't need it. I have a lot of company, a lot of friends and that, right? And we're always together in that. So, you know, we might go for wings or something once a week, like pre-COVID and that, or I'll sit in the backyard or whatever it is, right? We're always at somebody's house doing something, right? So there's always a
gathering. So you're way over the recommended limit. You know that, right? Like
I've known this for years of what they say is recommended, right? But, and I'm 54. I don't have any health issues, right? But again, the key is, I can't speak for everybody, but is to eat. You have to eat very healthy, too. You can't just drink. I know people that died of cirrhosis of the liver, but they were drinking, and they never ate, right?
Wow. All right. Well, Mike, listen, do me a favor. Take care, brother. And okay.
Maybe.
There's 10 drinks a day. I appreciate that, Mike. That's quite something. Jeff, what's going on, Jeff?
I got to up my game, man.
Or not. I don't know if that's your role, but that's kind of stunned me. Like, and maybe I'm in my own little bubble here, but 10 drinks a night seems to me like, whew.
Well, I have 4 beers plus half a bottle of sherry every night.
You have 4 beers and half a bottle of sherry a night?
Yeah. But I don't start until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, so.
And on the weekends, do you put back more?
No, it's usually about that. Some days I might have 3, like last night I had 5 because I had my friend come over and we had a few, so I over, but yeah, half a bottle.
So do you worry about any of these studies that, like, they say it's not healthy?
I'm tired of listening to doctors, especially after the pandemic. I have no use for doctors. Like the other guy, I exercise, I eat properly, so I just get a buzz on, pick up the guitar, start playing away, you know, watch movies and stuff like that.
Do you do weed? Do you smoke weed at all?
I used to, but when I had my children, I stopped doing it, but, yeah.
Wow, all right, well, listen, well, by the way, just before I let you go, what's your favorite song to play on guitar?
Well, I'm only in my second year of learning, right, but I listen to a lot of, like, Gregory Alan Isakoff? He plays his instrumental stuff.
Nice.
It's a stable song. You got to listen to it. This is fantastic stuff, man, just that kind of music like that.
Well, good stuff. Guitar's going to... change you for sure. All right, Jeff, thanks for that. I appreciate it. Man, I got to be candid, and I know I got to take a break. Keep texting me at 71010. I'm a little stunned at the amount that people drink. I am, and maybe I'm naive here, but let me take a break. I got a great story coming up that you'll want to stick around for. It involves bowling balls. Wait for it.
finding answers to all your questions. You're listening to The Evan Solomon Show.
Ah, the summer treasure hunt. Do you ever just think, I'm going to do a renovation and find something in the wall, dig a hole and find something in the ground, dig it in your garden and you hit something, it's like a movie. Remember the guy that was renovating his house here and he found bottles of whiskey from the 1920s, from the Prohibition era, we had them on? Well, we got another one. And I don't want to say that Dave Olson in Michigan has balls, but Dave Olson in Michigan has balls. 158 bowling balls. Yeah, he found them under his house, and Dave joins us now. David Olson in Michigan, great to have you on the program. Tell me what happened, how you found all these bowling balls. This is the weirdest find ever.
Well, thank you for having me, Evan. And I guess the story starts when I moved into the current home I live at 2 years ago. And we had an inspection done, and the inspector had noted that our steps in the back of our house needed to be demolished. And so anyway, took 2 years to get around to that project, but I finally started it 2 weeks ago. And it took some balls, but in my spare time, I got a hammer to strike the concrete, and I found a bunch of balls, 158 of them. And yeah.
So wait a second. You dismantle the stairs, and just describe, like, when you saw the first one, did you know what it was? Like, what, are they just buried in the backyard?
Yeah, it was really strange. It was, there's a concrete pad on top of a bunch of cinder blocks, and some of those blocks, the years and the mortar had fallen out. Right. So I was able to actually pull one of the blocks out and look in there, and I kind of dusted some sand away and saw a black and blue sphere, and I thought that was kind of strange. So I had continued to dig out and pulled the thing out, and it is the same size as a bowling ball, but at first I wasn't sure because there's no holes in it or markings in the first one, so I was definitely shocked at that point.
And then you just kept digging, and it's like, to find a couple bowling balls is one thing, but to find, like, 158. So then what happened? You must have been like, what the hell's going on here?
Yeah, definitely. I had pulled the one out, and then I was just kind of dusting through the sand, and they were packed in there really tight. So it's like, I couldn't really get them all out without removing the sand. So before I had even crushed anything up, I had pulled like 10 or 15 balls out. Like, this is crazy. And some of those balls that I found at that point had Brunswick, the manufacturer's name on it. So I started taking pictures and sent them to Brunswick. They have a facility. They don't make bowling balls anymore, but they have offices in my town. And they were able to give me some information on them because I was a little concerned about the safety of that, if it was a hazardous material or what I was dealing with.
So you pull out, like, were they all together or were they buried all over the property?
It was all in a space of, you guys use the metric system, so it's probably...
You can use feet. We do both. We can do it all.
A little flexible, but, flexible. Yeah, it's probably about a 5-foot by 8-foot section that was maybe 3 feet tall, and all of those balls were in that area. It blew
really?
My mind.
They all fit in that? So it was like this bowling ball coffin there. So why were they there in your backyard? That is the mystery. Has that been solved yet?
I think I've got a pretty good idea at this point. And I describe it as a sea of balls because as I was taking them out, I was pushing them behind me. And by the time I had gotten all the balls out, I could not walk behind me because the sea of balls was in the way. So at that point, I had my son pushing them off the ledge, and we'd getting them out of the way. But, through my Facebook group, the community just loved the story and passed it around to everyone. Well, come to find out, a few of the past Brunswick employees chimed in and had mentioned that in the 50s and 60s, they would put a dumpster out behind the building and fill it up with all their scrap. And it was actually like the employees were really happy to take that from them, and Brunswick was happy to get rid of it and not have to throw it in a landfill. So it was kind of like a reward to the employees to get to take the scrap balls. And I'm thinking the guy who owned my house realized that that was cheaper than dirt. It was basically a free fill. So he took advantage of that. And
that is crazy. So are they in good shape? Like, could someone use them, or are they all just degraded?
I think at this point there would be better purpose for art is what I'm using them for, but they're pretty degraded, and there's noticeable defects on all of them. Like, I think they had a machine that would actually gouge them up, because there's similar spirals on each of them that are like grooves cut into them, so that I'm guessing they just didn't want them to end up in circulation and make Brunswick look bad when a ball falls apart going down the lane.
It's just so crazy. So what are you going to use them for? You got 158 bowling balls in your yard. Like, what are you going to do with them?
Well, that was a question I asked the public in my group. And when I first started this thing, I was thinking maybe a few people will like it, but it turned into like 3,500 people actually seeing it and responding. And so I think I have just about every idea possible. However, I think the one that I started on the other day was using them for landscape edging, just to separate the grass from where I want to keep my plants. And so I dug a trench and popped them in there, and they look great. And I think for now I'm going to just put them all in like that, just to store them. And then some other ideas I had were to kind of go vertical with a sculpture, and I have to find a way to drill some holes into them, but put them on pipes and kind of stick them together that way. And
that is great. It could be a tourist attraction now.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Or either that, or I could start a new game called yard bowling, where you can just take the junk balls and throw them at whatever.
How old is your son?
I actually have three children, but the son that was helping me is five.
Oh my God, that is amazing. He must love it. Because I have like a 16-year-old, one of my kids is 16, and if I told my 16-year-old son I have a sea of balls in there, you know what kind of jokes he would be making. That's all I would hear, because that's what teenage boys are all alike. This would be his greatest story all ever. All his buddies would love it.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of some appropriate and some quite inappropriate puns out there. So,
oh, I bet you have. But you know what? How fun. Like, have you been getting calls from all over the world now, David?
Oh, yeah. It's my uncle's been following this really closely. And he actually had a friend in Brazil send him an article. So far, I have seen Brazil, Sweden, the Netherlands, Canada, of course. I did another radio interview 2 days ago now. But yeah, it's just one after the other. My messenger is just full of requests, and I'm trying to spread the word of positivity and do as many as.
Well, you know what I love? It's just like, it's the summer. We need some great stories. I love this story. Just, it's so crazy. 158 bowling balls under Michigan homeowner David Olson's house. He's going to use them to decorate his yard, maybe some yard bowling. David, good luck. That's fun. That's a great story. You put a smile on our face, and I can tell you what, right now a smile's worth $1 million. Thanks, my friend.
Right. Thank you for having me.
That's David Olson. That's great. All right. When we come back, we're gonna change it up. There's a new report out on the unmarked graves in Kamloops. The report is just out. They're literally doing the press conference right now. Mary Ellen Trappell LaFond, who's been a regular on our program, is going to give us the update next.
You're listening to the iHeartRadio Talk Network, and this is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the program. We have been waiting, sadly, for more news about what was the first, but certainly will not be the last, discovery of unmarked graves at former residential institutions. I hate using the word schools, because by any definition, they were not schools. And at the Kamloops residential, quote, school/institution, where 215 unmarked graves were found, they've done more surveying. And today the first report was coming out about that. And it turns out that the number could go up, because the headline so far is there still, get this, 160 acres in that location still to be surveyed. In other words, the number could go up. Now, someone who's helped us try to understand not only the gravity of this, where this is going, but the accountability question is Mary Ellen Terpel Lafond. She's been a regular on the program, professor of law at the University of BC, a former judge, a member of the Indigenous Bar, the director of the Indian Residential School History and Dialogue Center at UBC, so she knows her stuff. Mary Ellen Terpel Lafond, welcome back to the program. And I know this is going on right now. Can you just give our listeners across this country a sense of what this report says today?
Yes, thank you for having me back, Evan. It is a significant day because some six weeks ago, the information became public that Tshekemwik had located these approximately 215 shafts or indication of children's burials that the ground penetrating radar had initially reported. Today, Kukbi or Chief Roseanne Kazmir and the community is releasing the report, and the report that is peer-reviewed and validated by archaeologists with expertise in ground-penetrating radar and burial searching. And what they came forward with today is to say that the evidence is sound that the community brought forward, and it does suggest children's graves, and that they are unmarked. And it's one site, it's called the Orchard Site, approximately 2-acre site, and that both the oral history and the indication there is that there's more searching to be done. So it's significant today, Evan, because it speaks to the evidence and it corroborates and reinforces what the community said, that this is an important finding, and that, in fact, 20 years of work by this community has led to this and has validated what they've been speaking about for years.
So, but they have not necessarily identified any specific individuals there.
Well, no, that's the difficulty is, and I think I've spoken to you and to your listeners before about the fact that the records, and remember, they're only partial because we can't get all of the church records, and the government only required records after 1935. So the records only indicated 51 children had died during the school's operation. But this one burial site alone shows more than 200. So there is a disconnect. There's also the fact that these survivors, some of whom are speaking today, have for years talked about not only having to dig the graves of their relatives who had died, but also having many friends and siblings and family members never return. So the evidence today mounts. It's very sound and it is professionally accredited and reinforced. And this is important, Evan, because there were many corners in Canada where people were disbelieving the information. They were shocked, but they went to disbelief.
They didn't just disbelieve Mary Ellen Terpel Lafond. They did. Many people, and I get notes all the time, oh, Evan, you know, most of these kids died of TB. Don't you understand? People died of TB back then anyway. This is no different. And then you have to say the death rates here were A, significantly higher rates. B, there is no treatment. C, there is unmarked graves. Like, I don't even understand the point. But you know, the evidence, it's critical that we have good, sound evidence.
Yeah, you're right, Evan. And the thing is that, you know, the kids that died of TB, that is documented. And that's a different thing. This is unmarked burials, children that we don't know, and we won't be able to know exactly how they died, how old they were, and even who they were until further investigative processes are taken. And the community is indicating today, with support from the chiefs from all the various communities where the children were taken to attend the school, that they intend to pursue those next investigative steps.
There's 160 acres. That's remarkable.
Yeah, that's just one school, but they are, you know, this is 20 years of work they've done. But I think this is the key point, Evan, today is, you know, for Canadians and others, Canadians have been shocked. You know, they've gone from shock to anger to the wanting accountability, which is good. But I think they need to make some space to listen to what Kukbi Roseanne Kazmir is saying today. And what she's saying pretty strongly and clearly is, you know, they need government to step up and insist and support proper processes, investigative processes, that will assist them, provide the resources, make sure they're sound, and not leave this on their shoulders to manage and deal with alone.
Far be it for me to in any way add to what Mary Ellen Terpel-LaFonta said about this, but I would add, you said Canadians have gone from shocked, but I think the first step is denial, then shock. And I think we should not rule out the long generations of denial. You also mentioned Chief Roseanne Casimir. There's also accountability. And let me just, when you talk about listening, let's listen to her talk about the involvement from the church in that particular school.
There has never been an apology from the highest level of the Roman Catholic Church. To be clear, the Roman Catholic Church has repeatedly refused to accept responsibility or formally apologize for its direct role in the numerous and horrific abuses committed by Indigenous and children through the residential school system.
The other thing I should just quickly say is that survivors of that school / institution are speaking as we speak. But there is the accountability question that you've talked a lot about.
Yes, accountability is important, and for accountability to happen and for the truth to come out, the church is going to have to participate, and the Catholic entities that ran the school need to open their doors. Canada, and I know we've talked about this before, in 2015, Canada let the church off the hook for their financial commitments in the Indian residential school class action settlement. And when they got let off the hook in 2015, they kind of just shut everything down and didn't share. And so now, as Kukbi Roseanne says, you know, there has to be accountability. But let's just be really clear. Kukbi Roseanne Casimir and to Kamloops are also saying something about the Catholic Church, which is they acknowledge the bishop. They also acknowledge the importance that they want a proper relationship. So they're not speaking from a place of, you know, attack. They're speaking from a place of genuine accountability, which is they need the Catholic Church to come to the table with everything that they have to assist. And of course, for someone like myself, with more of a legal lens, you know, it does pop into my mind to think, should the church not perhaps also be paying for some of this?
Well, they, as you have spoken to us about, they were supposed to pay just a $25 million. They've never even risen to pay $4 million of the $25 million that they were supposed to pay. Mary Ellen Terpel-LaFonta, this is the beginning of a story, not the end of a story. We're seeing the report out of Kamloops today. I really appreciate you joining us and always taking the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
I'm just going to leave you here before I go to a break with one of the survivors. I think Mary Ellen Terpel-LaFonta said something that we've got to listen. Listen to a survivor of that school.
These residential schools took that away from us. Our language, our way of life, broken up families still happen today.
They still happen today. So what I'm going to do now is take a break. And I told you earlier in the program, I'm going to ask, what is the biggest issue that will affect your vote in the upcoming federal election? That will happen next month. And maybe it's what we just heard. Maybe this is the issue. Maybe it's the deficit. Maybe it's jobs. 1-855-633-1010. 1-855-633-1010 or 71010. What will affect your vote in the upcoming election? I need to know what you think.
As the story changes, we react. This is the Evan Solomon Show.
Welcome back to the show, 1-855-633-1010. That is your national call-in line to get your voice heard. What is the issue that will affect your vote? There will be an election, and I just really want to listen. I want to hear what people care about. You know, if I'm going to cover this election, I want to know what you think. I got lots of texts at 71010. Until Mr. Trudeau backs down on law-abiding gun owners, I have no choice but to vote conservative, even though I don't want to. That's an interesting one. Doesn't want to vote conservative, but the gun law, he will, or she will. Evan, I will not vote for a party that will not enforce the Catholic Church to pay for the atrocities they have done. So that issue is key. the church. And by the way, the federal government also has a responsibility in the residential school, but the church hasn't paid what they owe. And so the Catholic Church's responsibility and how the government's dealing with that will affect the vote. Evan, for me, it's about honesty and transparency, ethics. Ethics. Here's one that's interesting from Quebec. Hi, Ev. I've been a liberal all my life. I'm 51. But this will affect my vote because I live in Quebec. And if Trudeau doesn't help us on the Anglo factor, I will not be voting liberal anymore. He needs to help us keep our rights for the English. He hasn't done anything yet. This is about Bill 21. And this is about some fundamental issues on changing French as the official language. So that's a really big issue for a lot of voters in Quebec. And that may hurt Mr. Trudeau in Quebec. What issue is affecting you? Just let me know. What's the biggest issue that will affect your vote? Ethics? Climate? Jobs? Recovery? Pandemic? Indigenous issues? 1-855-633-1010. 7-1010. Guns? Child care? I don't care. I want to know. 7-1010. Ted, you're on the line. What's going on?
Hey, Evan, banger of a show. More than 15 drinks a week here. Sorry.
More than 15 a week. Man, yeah. What am I missing? Am I missing out on something here, or is everyone an alcoholic except for me?
I'm trying to temper it back a little bit. Believe me, I'm trying to get my butt moving again. But on this, I don't know who I'm voting for, but I will say I will not be voting for the Trudeau Liberals. I believe in accountability. I believe in transparency. I think the way the national offense file with Minister Sejan is being handled is just indicative of rot and ineffectiveness in this government. I think they did, in some regards, they did an okay job getting us through COVID. In other regards, I think they really fumbled the ball. I don't think any of the parties are perfect. I certainly want to see more from the Conservatives. I'm very disappointed in Jagmeet Singh thus far in the last couple of years. I don't know where my vote's going to go, but I know it won't be Trudeau Liberal. I'm tired of being patted on the head and dismissed like a child. We're adults. Deal with us straight up and give us the info. Let us make our own decisions.
Yeah, and that's interesting, Ted. First of all, I appreciate the call, and good luck on the getting your butt moving part. But that's interesting. People, there's not kind of an obvious choice here. Government been in power for 6 years. There's going to be a lot of dust on their boots, and a lot of that is about transparency and ethics. And the issue with the military and the allegations of sexual misconduct and the lack of accountability there are a big issue, Ted. Thanks. Rick, what's up?
I've been voting since I'm 61. I haven't missed a vote yet, but it's down to the point now after voting all these elections and who the best liar is. That's what it's down to right now. Because
you're cynical, Trudeau will say anything he wants
to get elected. And then people will follow that. And if you don't agree with them, you're a caveman or you don't believe in climate change or everything is 20, 30 years down the road. Yes, if you vote us in 20 years, we will have this. So, let me just ask you,
I'm intrigued by that cynicism and I get it because I hear a lot of it. But just out of interest, you're right. Some of that stuff is future. But, man, they're pumping out hundreds of billions of dollars today, right now.
But where are they getting the money from? I mean, they're pumping out billions today, which, like, Trudeau, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I voted conservative. I voted for some liberals at the odd time, like years ago. But, I mean, they just say what they want to say. And I'm, as a voter, I'm going, all right, whoever gives me the most and whoever the best liar will probably win. Because that's all people listen to is, oh, they're going to promise me this, they're going to promise you that, without any accountability. So
well, Rick, yeah, listen, and then you just get into the self-interest, which, okay, whoever gets me the most. Rick, I appreciate the call. I got to tell you, I'm hearing Rick. I think Rick's speaking for a lot of people. And Rick, it sort of saddens me that we've got this scar tissue on our democracy of cynicism. And I'm not saying you're wrong, Rick. I think there's been so many scandals over the years that it's hard to avoid that kind of democratic scar tissue. I try hard not to be cynical. I try hard to be what's called a skeptical optimist. I hope for better, but I'm skeptical. So I try to challenge the assumptions, as you know, I try to do every day. But Yeah, it's too bad. If you just think they're all liars, where do you go? Let me go to Tom. Tom, what's up?
How are you, Evan Sullivan?
I'm good, Tom. Thanks for calling in. What's your take?
My take is I really don't give a damn who wins the election. I would like to vote for a party that will guarantee minimum pension of $2,000 a month. Because what we're getting now is chicken food.
So, you know, the Liberals extended CPP, but you think you have to increase the pension.
Of course, and they should decrease the amount the illegal immigrants get when they come in here of $2,500 or so a month because they came illegally, and the people who worked here all their lives get scraps.
Are you a senior by any chance?
Yes, I am.
You're going to get $500 one-time dollar payment in the week of August 16th.
Big deal. It's already spent. Big deal.
The Liberal, I don't know what the Conservatives are doing. I haven't seen their platform. But you know that the Liberals, 2 years ago, they were going to provide a 10% boost to old age security at the age of 75 and a 25% increase to the Canada pension for widows. So they've done that.
I am a senior, but I have to live till 75.
Right. I appreciate the call. So that's a big issue for you. Thank you. Okay, so Tom, that's an issue. John, go for it.
Hey, Evan. Climate change is my number one issue. They got a whole host of problems. The conservatives, I'm sorry, they're not really a real party. Not really. Their whole thing is, you know, I want to give tax cuts to the rich, and I want to cut social programs to pay for it. But the thing that makes them not a real party is they can't even admit that the biggest issue of the century, maybe that the human race will ever face, they can't even say it's real. They embarrass
to be fair, Mr. O'Toole has said it's real. Mr. O'Toole has said it's real.
Yes, and then he was totally rebuked by his own party. It's the proof that he's just saying that because he knows he can't run an election and say climate change isn't real. He actually can't. So he knows he has to say it, and he tried to get his party to get fake on board with him, and they couldn't even get fake on board with him. Which means when say Aaron O'Toole wins a majority, there is literally no chance that he will ever pass anything to do with climate change, because what's he going to do? Make his whole base hate him.
All right. Well, climate change for you is a big deal. Let me read some. Thanks for the call. Evan, important to me, 1, economy. 2, healthcare spending. 3, military equipment. Problem is we have become a one political party country. Evan, I'm a card-carrying Liberal in Quebec, but I will not be voting for Trudeau because he's throwing Anglos under the bus for the last time, says Laurie. I wonder if that becomes an issue. Evan, I like what the Liberals have done, but I don't like Trudeau's lying and lack of transparency. Evan, I'm voting against all incumbents due to their pathetic handling of the pandemic, says John. John, you can only probably vote for your MP. I don't know. So maybe you're voting for, I don't know where your who your incumbent is. Ethics, a lot of integrity. Thanks. Send me more of what you're voting for and what this election could hinge on, what the ballot box question will be at 7:10:10. I'm going to ask my pal Scott Reed. He's going to join us. We're going to talk about Green Party meltdowns, the election and what he thinks. And does any country want the Olympics? The Olympics is going to start next week. Does anyone care? Is it the biggest financial boondoggle in the world, the Olympics? We'll talk about that, and then we have a special guest, a very special guest, to end the show.
Talking to the newsmakers every day, the conversation continues with Evan Sullivan.
Welcome back. It is time for Overhyped and Underplayed with Scott Reed, CTV's news political commentator, former DCOM for the former Prime Minister, Paul Martin.
Overhyped. Great jobs and opportunity.
In this election,
here's what I want to do.
Or underplayed.
Well, he's not overhyped. He's not underplayed. He's just perfect. He's just right there. Scott Reed. How's the summer going, Mr. Perfect?
Well, Mr. Perfect is enjoying summer. It's kind of a boring summer, I'm finding. You know, just kind of drifting along. I want to go somewhere. You know what I usually do, and this is the truth. I'm not making a joke here. Usually in August, I follow the Jays to an American ballpark. I take my two youngest sons with me, and it's a really great trip. We've done Chicago, we've done Boston, we've done New York, we've done Baltimore, on and on. And we didn't do it last year. We're not going to be able to do it this year because it's 2 weeks if you're under 12 and you're not vaccinated. So I'm not going to make the kids go through that after what they've been through. So I'm missing that. Like, that's something I really look forward to at the end of summer. So
that's a good father-son thing to do. I like that idea. That's a beautiful thing to do.
It's such a fun time.
Take them to the ballpark. Take them out to the ball game. And have you done Fenway Park?
We have done Fenway Park. And the tour at Fenway Park, for anyone that's ever thinking about it, because I always take them on the tour. Yankees, the tour was the worst that we've ever encountered. I was really disappointed because they got more history than anyone else. Fenway, the best. Just a great tour. And like 3 hours long, telling all kinds of great old stories. They had a dude in his 80s who was in great shape, telling stories about when he was a kid and all the places they would go in the park. And it was just fantastic. So, yeah, absolutely been to Fenway.
That sounds great. And I'm with you. You couldn't plan anything this holiday. So, you know, everyone's kind of trying to slip away wherever they can. But, yeah, I'm with you. It's kind of one of these summers where, listen, we're just happy that we got a summer at all. So something has just come across our desk, and I want to, because I've got you here for a while, Scott Reed. Survivors are currently telling their stories at a press conference in Kamloops about the unmarked graves found at the Kamloops Residential School. But this has just come across the desk. You know, in Manitoba, and most folks listening won't care about their Indigenous Minister for Indigenous Affairs resigned because Brian Pallister, the Conservative Premier there, had made comments about a potential race war in terms of reconciliation, and he's not retracted them. And the leader of the NDP is a guy named Wab Kanu, who happens to be Indigenous. He's been on this show. So then Pallister introduces a new Indigenous Reconciliation and Northern Relations Minister, okay? This guy, Dr. Alan Lagomorje, okay? And he starts off his first press conference. This is incredible. This is in the middle of a crisis over this, defending residential schools. Like, I can't even believe I'm hearing this. And Wab Kanu, the leader of the opposition, this is an encounter you never see in politics. Let me play this for you, and then I'm going to get you to talk about it. I think this is the most authentic moment. And if you want to see where the career of a guy named Wab Kanu, who's the leader of the NDP, may change, it's this moment right here. But listen to this. Listen to this minister. Here's what he just said.
The residential school system was designed to take Indigenous children and give them the skills and abilities they would need to fit into society as it moved forward.
What? No, it was not designed to do that. That is the absolute biggest crock lie. It's outrageous. And this guy's the minister in charge of it. So the Manitoba NDP leader, Wab Kanu, literally walks up and gives it to him. Listen to this.
I cannot accept you saying what you just said about residential schools. It was the express intent of residential schools to kill the Indian in the child. It is not cultural relativism. It is not revisionist history for us to say that that was wrong. Any right-minded person at the time should have known that it was wrong. Many did know and speak up against it.
Wab Kanu gets right in his face. Scott, I haven't seen anything like that. That's how politics should be done. A minister is up there essentially gaslighting over the residential schools, and the leader just gets up and calls him out.
Yeah, and for folks who haven't seen the clip, it's worth watching the clip, because what may not come through is that this new minister is being introduced as the new minister, is, you know, on the steps in the legislature talking, saying these things. And Kanu, like Wab, walks in to the television frame. Like, we don't even know he's there, and all of a sudden he just appears. He sort of comes in from stage right and says, "Hey, hold the phone. I can't sit idly silent by while you make that assertion." Like, it's very dramatic. Very, very emphatic. And of course, it's within a context, not just the context of, you know, today and at the press conference in terms of Kamloops, but also just the political context of Pallister's cabinet, right? His Minister of Indigenous Affairs, she quit and she didn't make a big hubbubaloo, right? But she found what the premier had said earlier in the week, where he said similar things, where he said, you know, look, I think, you know, we're better off. These people came, the people who built these schools, the people who put this system in place, they were trying to build something, and we're better off when we build together. And that minister, his own minister, said, I can't do my job and embrace those comments, so I'm just going to step aside. She didn't try to embarrass him in public. She just stepped aside as modestly as you possibly could. And so this is who Pallister picks. So I think you're forced to say that this is the official opinion of the government of Manitoba, because Pallister was at the source of this controversy. Then he picked somebody who presumably reflects his worldview. Sounds like he does. And good on Canoe for calling him on it. And I think it's emblematic of the controversy, and the conflict and the arguments that are happening, you know, all across the country, across family tables, you know, across bar stools. Like, people are having this argument. I've had it with people. Oh, well, you can't go back in time. And they were trying to do the right thing then. And they were trying to erase everything that was Indian about Indian kids. And, I mean, even by the standards of the time, it was bad.
What will be the ballot box question on the election?
Safe hands. Safe hands. You can't trust anybody else to guide us out of COVID, just as you couldn't really have trusted anybody else to have guided us through COVID. They're going to try to leverage the equity, the government, the federal government, the federal liberals, they're going to try to leverage the equity they had coming out of COVID and saying, we struck the right balance. We backed you. We said we'd do whatever it takes. That's the same attitude that we will apply to the economic recovery. We're not
what
do
the conservatives have to do to counter that, or the NDP?
Conservatives have to say, sorry, next war isn't the last war. We're out of this. We have to be preoccupied with straightforward pocketbook issues. You guys as a government are just too comfortable trying to re-engineer society. You see it as an opportunity to rewire how the country works. You're just too eager to spend and not worry about the debt. You're too eager to do all these big, fancy things and forget about the fact that I can't purchase a house and my kid can't purchase a house because the cost has gone through the roof. Cost of everything else is going up. You're telling me that all the bunch of technical reasons why I shouldn't be worried about inflation. Pocketbook, pocketbook, pocketbook. Try to make it about the future, not about the past, and try to make it pocketbook. That's where I think the conservatives should go. But I don't know where they're going to go, because they're all over the map, Evan, and that's the problem, is that conservatives haven't been coherent for months, maybe years.
What about the NDP, real quick?
And if the NDP will say, you know what, Trudeau is going to bring an end just as fast as he can to the things that made sense and the supports that were put in place during COVID, I'm going to continue them. We're going to continue with the supports for jobs. We're going to continue with the supports for the small business people that need them. We're going to continue and reinforce those supports in hospitals and schools. I think that's where they'll go. They'll say, you know what? Trudeau will smile at you as he stops those things. We are going to extend them.
Scott Reed, okay, overhyped and underplayed. I haven't even got to overhyped and underplayed. Olympics, we'll get to overhyped or underplayed. Then someone that cannot be overhyped. You've got a very special guest who will join us at the end of the segment coming up. It is going to be, for me, a sad moment, and someone that you listeners will know very, very well. You know about her sleeping arrangements. You know how much I tease her about drinking, which she doesn't really do. You know about her grandmother, and she will join us next. Mystery guest next.
When important decisions are made, we report. Here's Evan Solomon.
Scott Reed is here for our favorite segment of the week, Overhyped or Underplayed?
Overhyped. Create jobs and opportunity.
In this election,
here's what I want to do.
Or Underplayed.
Scott Reed, and then we'll have our special guest I'll introduce in a quick second, but the Tokyo Olympics are coming up. Cost about $17 billion to put that on. There's going to be no spectators. They'll lose between $800 and $1 billion there. It's going to be a massive money loser. Are the Olympics at this point overhyped or underplayed? And is it a curse to get the Olympics?
They are definitely overhyped. This set of games are definitely overhyped. We've talked about it and talked about it, and yeah, it's obviously a woolly mess. But what do you do? Like, they're not going to be any spectators, so they're going to lose money. That's the way it goes. You decided to proceed with it during COVID. You took your risk to the V. I don't think it has to be a curse. I think if you could actually, it's not beyond the ken of mortals to have the games, run the games, and make them work. I just don't think that it's impossible to find someone that's capable of pulling that off. But these games, we're in a mess, so they're a mess.
I love the idea of the Olympics. It's basically like a dorm room party. When it's happening, it's the greatest thing ever. When it's on, I love it. Then afterward, there's a massive hangover. There's crap everywhere, and there's a lot of regret. And how did I do? Then you got like a tattoo on your back or something. It's a bad thing to happen. But during it, I'm gonna love it when it's going on. It's a great thing. What do you do with the velodrome? You probably have your own personal velodrome. You're so successful.
That is the measure of success. Some people say it's taking your own spacecraft into the solar system. No, it's a velodrome.
Yeah, I know, because Bezos is going to be like, space was good, but check out the size of my velodrome. By the way, a lot of people aren't showing up. A lot of athletes not showing up for the Olympics. You'll watch it, though, because you know why? You and I are suckers. It's like a bag of chips. You put on something sports with high drama, I'm there. That's my problem.
3 years and 50 weeks of my life, I forget that I have any interest in the Olympics. And then for 2 weeks, I suddenly am an expert in whatever, Belgian caper tossers or something. I completely get absorbed by it.
Yeah, I'm with you. And it's not the caper toss is Scottish, not Belgian. But anyway, Scott Reed, CTV News political commentator. Get ready for the election. No bowl clubs. Let's bring on our special guest. I want you to say goodbye, and I'm going to do a tribute. This is not only, I'm going to take a short break after the show today, but this is the last day of our show before our great and powerful and brilliant, her producer, Hannah Berge, who is the mastermind of every guest. She is the wizard behind this program, is leaving. She is moving from radio to television. She's going to be the producer of a daily television show at CTV in Ottawa. And Hannah, this is your last day. Throughout your time on the Evan Solomon Show as the pioneer, what did you do? You just revealed that you don't sleep with your partner in the same bed. You sleep in the living room. Your grandmother weighed in. I teased you about being an alcoholic, which I know you barely even drink. But you are, without a doubt, the most incredible, humane, wonderful partner and friend. And this show owes any success it has to you, not me.
Well, thank you, Evan. I don't know if that's completely true at all. But no, it's an emotional day for sure. I'm very sad to leave. I'm obviously excited to start the new job, but truly every day on this show has been amazing.
The thing about this show, and Scott will know, because I know you talk with Scott, and I'll give Scott a word here, but Hannah and I only worked together for a couple of months in the same studio before the pandemic hit. And this is one of those things where, and Chris Viss and Donnie who in Toronto and the guests, we all feel so close to each other. And what a testimony to Hannah, your ability to connect in this virtual world. Like, I feel like we've worked together every single day so closely. We never saw each other.
I know, it's crazy. Since last March, I think we've seen each other maybe one or two times. But it doesn't feel that way at all.
No, and listeners got to know you. You battled cancer. Your skin cancer, you were very open about that. You were always, we exposed every part of our life. Scott and I talk every day, and Scott, you can just say, give Hannah a tribute. But, Hannah, who's in her 20s, she was so comfortable sharing the most intimate details of her life with our listeners. And any listener that wants to send Hannah a good luck message at 71010, please do so. Scott.
That is completely where I'm at. I love working with you, Hannah. It's been a blast. But the word that jumps to mind is fearless, because I'm not just a guy who's on the other end of the email or the telephone. I'm a listener too, and I hear you on this show, and I think, my God, she is boundlessly courageous coming on and talking about the stuff, sharing all this, letting this guy talk about where you sleep at night and who you do and don't sleep with. I mean, come on. It's unbelievably fearless. So I will miss you. Best of luck. And by the way, I would imagine that seeing you very infrequently, Evan, would be a secret to success.
Yes. No, that was a bonus for Hannah, for sure. The infrequent sightings were good. Hannah, any message to Scott? Give Scott a word of wisdom, because could he use some corrective action from you? Anything.
Oh, gosh. You're catching me on the spot here. You two are both, like, you're just, I feel so grateful to work with both of you. Like, you're such great mentors. And I just feel so grateful for the friendships that have developed while working on this show.
Hannah, just...
I have enjoyed teaching you how to drink hard so much.
Well, you're definitely the drinker. Hannah, I just want to say something, and our listeners at 71010, and you can thank them as well. I'll give you an opportunity. This is all about the listeners. We have great debates on the program, great conversations. We try to keep it real. We try to fight the spin, get the facts out there, but also listen to people. And the listeners are grateful, and you speak to a lot of them. And any word to our listeners across this country who have been enjoying your work for so long?
Yeah, for sure. You say a lot, Evan, that this show is like a family, and it truly is. That's why I feel so comfortable talking about the most intimate details of my life. And, you know, when I shared my skin cancer diagnosis, everyone sent the most wonderful messages, and it really helped. And I truly do feel like we are like a family. And I just want to thank the listeners for that, because it is incredible.
I think you said the word, it's a family. Listen, from my wife, Tammy, who's gotten to know you as well, we send you love. I just really thank you. It is a family. I know Chris Viss, who is on the board, who comes to our story meetings, and Donnie, and Mike Ben Dixon, who's the head of the Bell Media Talk Network, and all of the syndicated stations. We've benefited from your work. We're going to get a great person in, folks. Don't worry. We're looking for a great person, and Hannah's trained a lot of people. Hannah, good luck in television. You know, I have no problem. I think you can work in television and radio, and I think it's great. But I really mean when I say it's been one of the privileges and honors and pleasures working with you. You are just a sensational human being. You've got a remarkable career ahead. And I'll just say, on behalf of our family here at the Bell Media and the iHeartRadio Talk Network, thank you, Hannah Berge, to your mom. We love your daughter, to your grandma who listens. We love it. And you're a great, great person. I know I'll be working for you one day. So applause to Hannah Berge. This is her last show with me. She'll stay on the show for a couple more weeks with the guest host. But Hannah, all my love, my friend, you're the greatest. And
thank
for
you
to
so
my
much.
Listeners, I will be taking a short break. We will be back in time for the election. I'll be doing some television when the Governor General is installed later this month. But that's the Evan Solomon Show today. Take care. Hug your loved ones, and talk soon.